From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, swift action being called for to curb migrant deaths in the Mediterranean. Saudi coalition airstrikes reportedly hitting Houthi rebels in Yemen. Palestine and economic development highlight the Asia-Africa conference. And a new report on the environment and society.
How can we all get a piece of a dignified life on this planet without trashing the planet? I think that's the big challenge.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. 700 people or more are feared dead from the capsized migrant vessel off the coast of Libya. The exact number will likely never be known. By nightfall Sunday, authorities said 28 people had been rescued about 200 kilometers south of the Italian island of Lampedusa, and another 24 bodies were recovered. Rescue workers said the majority of the missing appear trapped in the 20-meter vessel at the bottom of the sea. The Southern European representative of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Laurent Jolz, says the hard-pressed Italian Coast Guard is unprepared for such operations.
The Coast Guard are, you know, with the small capacity that they have, are doing whatever they can to rescue lives, going very, very close to Libya if necessary, and you know, working non-stop day and night. But it is clear that they need help. They need help either financially, but, you know, substantially, or there has to be something else put in place in a European context, and that really needs to happen.
The mass drowning, if confirmed, would bring the death toll this year to 1,500.
Chiediamo di non essere lasciati soli, non tanto nell'emergenza in mare.
Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi says his country cannot be left alone to deal with this crisis. He called it more than a humanitarian tragedy, but a national security matter to bring a halt to human trafficking. In his weekly address in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis called on the international community to prevent more migrant disasters. The pontiff also called for much greater international involvement in the burgeoning crisis. International and humanitarian agencies are calling for swift action to prevent the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean. Lisa Schlein has more on the story from Geneva.
International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA search and rescue missions are continuing.
The waters are calm and the weather is fair right now. The authorities believe that there remains a chance to find people. You know, it's a big sea out there, and it's easy not to see people. But generally, if someone's missing, they're drowned. That's been our experience, although there also are cases where some bodies are recovered.
The majority of migrants making this perilous journey are from sub-Saharan Africa, Eritrea, Somalia, and Syria. European Union ministers are discussing possible solutions in Luxembourg. The International Organization for Migration is asking the European Union to once again back life-saving operations on the scale of the Italian-run Mare Nostrum program. That program rescued thousands of migrants at sea, but was shut down last year on the grounds it encouraged people to risk their lives on smugglers' boats. IOM spokesman Millman says governments must become creative in their search for solutions.
We know places like Agadez and Niger that are full of people on their way to Tripoli. Khartoum is full of people on their way to Tripoli. These are very traditional points along the migrant route, and we believe that organizations could be there with a desk and a computer set up and saying, we are going to start registering people. We are going to start seeing who has family in one of these countries in Europe, who could qualify for a humanitarian visa, who could be resettled on a temporary basis with their family.
Millman acknowledges opening such a channel could provoke a stampede of migrants. But given the choice between temporary legal entry to a country and mass slaughter on the seas, he says a stampede is probably the better choice. The smugglers' trade is flourishing in Libya because it is a failed, lawless state. The United Nations is mediating peace talks in that strife-torn country in an effort to reach a power-sharing agreement among the warring parties that could bring stability and curb human smuggling. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Saudi-led coalition launched more airstrikes overnight in Yemen, including one that caused a giant explosion. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Yeah! Amateur video showed a giant ball of fire followed by a massive explosion after a Saudi coalition airstrike on an arms depot outside the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. The Houthi militia group's Al-Masira TV showed live video of a giant mushroom cloud hanging over the skies of the capital several hours later. Homes and other buildings were shattered by the blast. The report said the Saudi-led coalition used banned weapons containing depleted uranium. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported the airstrike detonated a stock of Scud missiles and other rockets in a Houthi arms depot. Yemen's acting health minister, Dr. Ghazi Ismail, told Yemeni media the blast caused numerous casualties. He said at least 30 people were killed and more than 350 wounded by shrapnel, flying debris, glass, and smoke inhalation. He also said casualty numbers are likely to rise further. The Houthi TV report showed what it said were victims of Saudi airstrikes being treated at a hospital in Sana'a. The report urged Yemenis to donate blood to cope with casualties from recent airstrikes. The head of the Houthi militia group, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, said in a televised address the Yemeni people had a right to fight back against what he called the outside aggression. He went on to say his group is fighting to rid Yemen of al-Qaeda. He says al-Qaeda is a threat to the north and the south of Yemen and that it now controls parts of the country. He said his group is trying to help Yemenis in the south defeat the group. Acting Yemeni Foreign Minister Riyad Yassin, who is loyal to internationally recognized Yemeni President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, told a news conference in Kuwait the Houthis are to blame for the widespread destruction of Yemen's infrastructure. Yassin said the Houthi militias were attacking civilians in a chaotic fashion in the cities of Taz and Aden and were arresting people for no reason. He added that Yemenis understand why the Saudi-led coalition is waging the current battle. Yassin also denounced a four-point peace plan by Iran, urging Yemenis to sit down for national dialogue talks in Saudi Arabia. Saudi military spokesman General Ahmed Asiri told journalists late Sunday that coalition aircraft had flown 2,300 sorties in the 25 days of military operations over Yemen. He said large caches of Houthi weapons had been destroyed and that a second stage of operations is beginning to prevent the Houthis from being able to move around. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Ethiopia has confirmed that 30 of its nationals were killed by Islamic State militants in Libya. Confirmation came today, day after the Islamic State group released a graphic video purporting to show Ethiopian Christians being decapitated or shot in the back of the head. An Ethiopian government statement condemned what it called the inhuman mass murder of its citizens. It said Parliament will meet Tuesday to declare a period of national mourning and announce measures the government will take in response to the killing. The video is similar to one released in February, showing militants cutting off the heads of Egyptian Christians. An Arab League official told the French news agency military chiefs from the region would meet in Cairo this week to discuss creating a joint force against the Islamic State group. The United States already is leading an international coalition carrying out airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria and Iraq, allowing Iraqi forces to seize back areas from militants. On the second day of the Asia-Africa conference in Jakarta, Indonesia's foreign minister advocated for an independent Palestinian state and promised that the summit will produce a unified political message. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports, improving economic ties is the top priority for many of the delegates, especially in Africa, where development has lagged behind Asia.
High-ranking ministers from over 70 participating countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East gathered in Jakarta for the second day of the Asia-Africa Conference. The week-long summit and commemoration seeks to revive ties among developing countries that first came together in Indonesia 60 years ago at the historic Bandung Conference. In her opening remarks, Indonesia's Foreign Affairs Minister Retno Marsudi noted that support for independence from colonialism was the cause that united these countries in 1955. At this year's conference, she says Indonesia wants to make independence for the Palestinian territories controlled by Israel a similar unifying cause.
An issue that also merits our continued support and attention is the issue of Palestine. Indonesia remains steadfast in its wavering support for an independent Palestine within the context of two-state solution.
The Palestinian foreign minister, Riyad Mawki, also addressed the conference Monday. He pressed the delegates to consider a new push for full membership for Palestine at the United Nations and to put economic pressure on Israel.
We should start talking about sanctions being imposed on Israel for violating international law and for negating the Palestinians' their basic rights.
The United Nations General Assembly voted in 2012 to grant Palestine non-member observer state status in the UN. A proposal for setting a deadline for granting the Palestinian region statehood later failed to pass the UN Security Council. While there may be broad support for Palestinian statehood at the conference, many African delegates have come to Jakarta seeking better trade ties. So far, there has been much talk about South-South and triangular cooperation. These are terms that refer to how emerging countries like Indonesia either provide direct aid or, with advanced countries, provide assistance to less developed countries. But there have been few specifics offered as to what kind of programs they are talking about and how much monetary support might be offered. Samori Angwa Okwiya, Kenya's High Commissioner to Indonesia, Philippines, and Brunei, says details will be forthcoming this week.
Since the last conference, we are looking at very new areas of interest. I can't really go into details right now, but I'm sure at the end of the summit, we'll be able to come up with very concrete resolutions that are going to affect the cooperation between Asia and Africa.
Some delegates say the bilateral talks happening on the sideline are just as important as the main conference in making trade and development deals between African and Asian countries. Berhain Gabra Christos, a high-ranking ambassador with Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is optimistic after meeting with his Indonesian counterpart.
We're going to work on details, but the potentials are huge on agriculture, on labor-intensive investments like textile, oil, and name it.
Tuesday, heads of state from China, Japan, South Africa, Ethiopia, and Pakistan are scheduled to address the conference. And on Friday, a number of heads of state will travel to Bandung to reenact a historical procession that was part of the first conference 60 years ago. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Pakistan to launch a major investment program to boost the South Asian country's infrastructure and energy needs. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor will involve a network of rails, roads, and pipelines through Pakistan to facilitate the transport of oil from the Arabian Sea and Indian Ocean to China. The two countries are also expected to cooperate in gas, coal, and solar energy projects to provide more than 16,000 megawatts of electricity, about double Pakistan's current capacity. In an editorial Sunday, the state-run China Daily Global Times says Beijing views the relationship as one between equal partners, referring to Pakistan as China's iron brother. It says over the next 15 years, the $46 billion Chinese investment will include the construction of roads, railways, pipelines, fiber optic cables, power facilities, and economic development zones. China analyst Kerry Brown of the University of Sydney, Australia, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, this project is part of China's economic initiative of greater cooperation called One Belt and One Road.
Pakistan and China have been very close allies, at least rhetorically, for a long time. And it's really, I suppose, a moment under Xi Jinping when, you know, with his new sort of worldview, this idea of, you know, the new Silk Road, basically, the one road, one belt, It's a time of seeing where Pakistan fits into that. There are all sorts of security issues that Pakistan and China do have in common, but also have issues over. And there's also a sense in many ways that Pakistan has not actually got as much economic benefit from this relationship as it could have. So I think this is really a moment when they can recharge this relationship and see where it slots into all of the other things that China is doing in the region, rather than, you know, just assuming that they have a great relationship and not really doing anything about it.
This is a major investment package, $46 billion. It dwarfs the U.S. aid package going to Pakistan. Is China kind of filling a vacuum now that the U.S. has pulled back from Afghanistan?
I think it's very vulnerable. It doesn't share a huge border with Pakistan, but it's strategically a very important one. And obviously, even with the issue of America now withdrawing from Afghanistan, the kinds of security issues that poses for China, particularly in the Xinjiang region, where it does feel that it has enormous security issues, you know, this means that Pakistan is strategically very important for China. It's a country that it has always enjoyed good diplomatic relations with, but it doesn't really have a strong kind of cultural dialogue with the country. And so there's all sorts of possibilities for misunderstanding. And the bottom line basically is China shares a border and also shares strategic space with Pakistan in ways which are much more immediate and pressing than America. America is remote. Pakistan is right next to China. So it feels it needs to have a stronger voice there and a stronger reason for being there. And economic links, of course, and aid packages are very, very tangible ways of promoting this link.
How would you equate relations between those two countries with China's relationship with India?
Yes, I mean, the issue really is that with India, China still has an unresolved border issue, well, two unresolved border issues. And so it's always got a very complicated relationship, particularly now that India is economically much more important. There's competition between the two. And Pakistan sort of sits between them. It's got a very complex relationship with India, of course. It's historically been a complicated relationship. And it doesn't look like even in the era in which both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers that that's going to get any less complicated. In a sense, the danger for China is that it could be played by Pakistan against India, less likely that India would play it against Pakistan. And so it needs to really defend its interests with Pakistan, its security interests, its trade interests, its strategic interests, but not get drawn into the very, very complicated India-Pakistan issues where, you know, it may be forced to take sides. It just definitely doesn't want that.
The Chinese leader will also discuss terrorism and military sales during his two-day visit. Mr. Xi's visit was supposed to have taken place during his South Asian tour last year, but was postponed among anti-government protests in Pakistan. The World Watch Institute says hidden threats are imperiling the quest for sustainable societies around the world. In its new report, State of the World 2015, it says growing stress on the planet's resources could cause social upheaval, environmental imbalances, and disrupt economies. We spoke with World Watch Institute's Gary Gardner about the new publication.
In this edition, we wanted to try to focus on some of the issues that don't get as much attention as the more high-profile, you know, climate change and other issues that are dominating the headlines. So we pulled up a number of issues that we have been looking at for years and just wanted to try to feature them in this report.
What are those issues?
We're looking at, for example, growth, the problem of economic growth and how you can have infinite economic growth on a finite planet. I mean, on the face of it, that is problematic, and we explore that a little bit. We're looking at issues of agriculture and the loss of agricultural resources, such as water and land and a stable climate. We look at things like stranded assets. This is something that has often focused on coal and oil, And the question being, can we continue to use these resources, and are they in fact still good investments for people if they will not be able to be pumped or mined in the future because of their carbon content? So it's a range of issues.
And could you give us some examples of how we can solve some of these problems?
Sure. In terms of agricultural resources, I think we need to be much better stewards of the land and water and, of course, the climate. We tend to look at land and see it as a commodity, for example, so we pave it over. And in the case of California, between 2008 and 2010, it lost an area of farmland that was equal to about three-quarters of the area of San Francisco. In the United States as a whole, we've lost an area equal to the state of Indiana in 25 years that's been paved over, a farmland that's been paved over. So we need to be much better stewards, and we need to be treating food, for example, as a sacred commodity, not just another thing that we trade. It turns out that about one-third of the food in the world today is wasted, either at the farm level or at the home level or somewhere in between, and that's a huge loss. So we need to develop, I think, a better understanding of the value and importance of food.
Some people, especially in third world countries that are just coming along, they feel that the environment is secondary. They want to get ahead. They want to get up with everyone else. What is your reaction to that?
Well, it's very understandable, of course, when you need a job, when you need to feed your family, when you need to be able to get health care. All of those things are primary, I think, in any parent's worldview. So it's totally understandable. And the challenge for us in the 21st century is to build economies that are not in competition with the environment so that we can provide a lot of the economic goods and services that people need without having a huge environmental footprint. And that's the challenge we face moving forward. And there are ways to do that. When we talk now about circular economies, for example, economies in which there's very, very little waste because everything gets either recycled or reused or is turned into a service so that, for example, car sharing, which we're seeing increasingly in many cities, people can get access to a car without having to own a car. And that means that people have the transportation service they're looking for without all of the environmental impact that comes with production and of you know, very resource-intensive good like a car.
When I was young, which was, of course, a very, 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 very long time ago, a lot of people just didn't care about the environment. They thought it was silly. But those opinions seem to have turned around now. People are much more accepting of thinking the environment is important.
I think so. I think you're absolutely right, and that gives me some hope for the future. And I, you know, as I indicated, we're trying to retool our economies so that they work in harmony with the environment. And I think that's a really exciting challenge and will be a fun and creative kind of challenge for the upcoming generations. How can we all, you know, get a piece of a dignified life on this planet without trashing the planet? I think that's the big challenge, and I'm very much looking forward to being part of that.
Gary Gardner, a senior fellow and director of publications at World Watch Institute. A record amount of electronic waste was generated last year, according to a United Nations University report. In 2014, 41.8 million tons of e-waste, mostly cell phones, refrigerators, washing machines, and other domestic appliances, were dumped around the globe. Less than a sixth of that was properly recycled, said the report, prepared by the UN's Education and Research Branch. The United States and China generated the most waste. However, countries that regard themselves as environmentally conscious top the list for per capita waste, leading with Norway and followed by Switzerland, Iceland, Denmark, and Britain. Worldwide, e-waste constitutes a valuable urban mine, a large potential reservoir of recyclable material, said UN Undersecretary General David Malone. According to the report, metals and discarded devices include gold, silver, iron, and copper, worth $52 billion. Malone also cautioned that electronic waste is a toxic mine that must be managed with extreme care. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also listen to the show again if you want, or yesterday's show. Go to voanews.com. over to the Programs tab. You'll see it in the upper right-hand corner. And scroll on down to International Edition to listen. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.